Hey A1 fans, Andy here. We're going to Cisco Live and we can't wait to see you there. If we see you wearing an A1 or Cables to Cloud shirt at Cisco Live, we'll enter you in our giveaway that includes a bunch of cool prizes like an A1 branded Yeti cup and an OCG of your choice from our friends at Cisco Press. Don't have a shirt? No problem. Head to the link in our bio and grab yours today. See you soon.
This is the Art of Network Engineering podcast. In this podcast, we'll explore tools, technologies, and talented people. We aim to bring you information that will expand your skill sets and toolbox and share the stories of fellow network engineers.
Welcome to the Art of Network Engineering. I'm Tim Bertino, and this is the podcast where we ask the smart questions, lead the study session live streams, create hilarious profanity-laced educational posts, and yes, we work on rockets as well. Actually, that's not we at all. That is all accomplished by my excellent co-host for this evening. Lexi, how you doing?
That was a hell of an introduction. Made me sound like I'm up there on the launch pad just tinkering, you know? I appreciate that, Tim. I'm doing all right. It's been a hectic day. I learned a lot today. I can't talk about any of it, you know, but it's been a great day of learning. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Not to that level on my side by any means, but yeah, learning stuff every day, still trying to figure out this new role at work and trying to kind of balance the still kind of the day-to-day operations as well as getting more involved in business level meetings and trying to come up with solutions and high level stuff like that. So it's been exciting and still going through the enterprise design Cisco stuff. So I feel like I'm half-ish way through studies that I'll be ready to try that exam. So yeah, been exciting.
You act like you're not learning anything. You're learning probably more than me, actually. That's what it sounds like.
No, it's been fun. It's been a crazy 2022 already. I probably said that like 17 times already this year. But
I feel like that's a common theme. Like 2022 has been a little wild. And it seems like in general and for a lot of us in our lives individually, heard a lot of crazy stories already.
I actually just brought that up to my wife earlier today. I just kind of sat back and I was thinking about everything that's already happened here in 2022. I'm like, was 2021 like even a tenth of the craziness that's already happened this year?
I think
it's
so.
Nuts.
Yeah. So I think this is going to be a wild year if the first 2 months are
any indication. Yeah, I agree.
Hopefully a good wild year. There's good wild and there's bad wild.
So do you have anything in the new town, in the new place, exciting that you want to, what's your favorite thing so far?
Oh my God. Yes. Okay. You can see Mount Rainier just like straight up from my, right outside my door. It's so good. I told my coworkers were asking me like, hey, how do you like it in the area? Like, how's it going? And I was like, it's pretty nice. Like I could see Mount Rainier when I go outside, and they were all like, okay, well, that's a flex. Wow. All right. Fancy pants. You know, I didn't realize that. I'm not used to like mountains because I'm from Houston, the land of flat industrial crap. And so it's like, you know, you don't never see anything in like the distance except for more like flat, you know, roads and stuff. Yeah. Right. So there's no like mountains. So it's just like amazing to me in general that there's mountains that exist in this place and I can look out the window and see them. And then there's this big one. So I don't know how used to Mount Rainier people are, but I just assumed everyone could see it. You can't see it everywhere.
Wow, that's exciting.
Yeah, it's awesome. So I'm really enjoying the area for sure.
Excellent.
Not so much the time zone of PST, as I've mentioned before.
That's got to take some time, no pun intended, to get used to.
Yeah, I like wake up super early, right? For most people, because I'm used to like being 2 hours ahead of this, but that's like sort of where that like advantage stops, right? Because then I have to stay later at work.
Yeah.
and then I, you know, I just have to rush to get to things after work, basically, because everyone's already started on their evenings, but it's all right. It's worth it.
Yeah, we're making it difficult for you. Dan and I are at least in Central Time. Those Eastern guys, those are the ones making your life difficult.
I didn't realize y'all were both in Central.
It took me forever to figure that out because Dan is in Tennessee, and I just assumed he was Eastern.
Where are you, Tim?
I'm in Nebraska.
If you don't mind me. Oh, I definitely thought you were on the East Coast. No. I'm sorry.
No.
I thought y'all were all over there except, well, I guess Dan. I knew Dan was in Tennessee.
Yeah, I always thought Dan was Eastern time just because, you know, down in the South over there. So, but no, he's Central. It's Andy and AJ that bring up the Eastern time.
God damn it. Yep. Those guys always ruining everything.
I would love to hang around and complain about Andy and AJ some more, but it is actually time for the wins. Winning this week in our It's All About the Journey Discord channel. First up, John Capobianco had his last day after 8 years with the Parliament of Canada. We know John is very excited about his developer advocate role at Cisco, but he put so much time, sweat, I'm sure some tears the last years bringing up the Parliament of Canada to what it was when he left it. So congratulations, John. I'm sure it was a sad day, but looking forward to your future.
Yeah. Congrats, John. That's fantastic.
I should have led with, this week's wins should win an award for the names that we're getting this week, starting with John Capobianco. And now this one, I need to talk to this person because I'm sure there's a backstory behind this name and avatar image, but I'm a Triscuit. Yes, the cracker, the Triscuit cracker.
Right,
I'm a Triscuit, knocked out the DevCore exam. I can't imagine how difficult that was to take on. So congratulations there. Andrew Rodero secured another Sans coin during the SEC 503 class capture the flag contest. He's really gotten some cool challenge coins through those capture the flags. Those are really neat. And Michael Hilton. Yes, that Michael Hilton secured a job as a network engineer with Apple starting very soon. Congrats, Michael.
Awesome. And, wow.
And another fun name to say, NetStackology. Passed the AZ-900 exam. Congrats.
I love that user.
Yeah, that was awesome.
There's always at least one that I love every
I had to make week. Sure I said it in my head a few times to make sure I was actually saying it correctly.
NetStackology and I'm a Triscuit. Those two. Yeah,
that's excellent. And to round it out, one of our good friends from across the pond, Ethan, passed the JNCDA. Congrats, Ethan.
That's fantastic.
And just one thing to add, if you want to join our Patreon program, go check it out at patreon.com/artofneteng. All right, let's get into it. We have a very exciting interview this evening for this episode. We have the one and only Christopher Hart with us. Christopher, how are you?
Hey, good evening, morning, afternoon, wherever you are. I'm doing well. How about you?
Doing good. We're happy to have you on. This is exciting. I've been wanting to talk to you in public on a recording for a long time.
Well, honored to be here as usual, or not as usual. Honored to be here.
I think my intro to you, Christopher, has been Twitter. Just being able to scroll and see a multi-step post of just tips, tricks, things you've seen on the job. It's been really cool. It's always really interesting and really educational. So that's my intro to you.
You have written about so many bugs that I've seen before. Like it's so cool. Like it's so cool. So, you know, I think a lot of people know you as like, you know, working in tech with Cisco, right? So, and you, mm-hmm. you work directly with like, it was the Nexus platform, right?
Yes. Yeah. So Nexus specifically running NXOS. I'm glad to hear that the Twitter threads tend to have that a lot of people tend to see a lot of value in them. I'll be quite honest. I'm really just trying to see how long I can make them before Twitter tells me to stop. I'm trying to see if there's like a max limit.
Have you reached it yet?
No, I have not. So we'll see though. I mean, they each get progressively longer eventually. I'm expecting it'll be like maybe around 64. It'll be a power of two for sure. So we'll see what happens.
Good luck. Please keep making them.
Yeah, I happen to be filling them with useful information, I suppose. So I'm glad everybody tunes in for that.
Yeah, they're awesome. You wrote one about like a config save bug. And I'm trying to remember, but I remember thinking like, I've been gone from my last job for like maybe 3 months and I'm already forgetting like everything. But I remember thinking like, I have seen this and I can't believe you just broke it down, because sometimes, you know, like I was working a break fix at a knock, and we were like, you know, at a certain, you have to find that sweet spot between like, okay, troubleshoot the issue, figure out why, but then you got to fix it. And then you kind of have to move on because you're closing out tickets, right? So when I worked on that, or when I, you know, saw it and just working on tickets having to do with that bug, like I never fully got like the answers that I wanted behind the why, just because we didn't, I think at the time, like have time to ask why and like learn the very minute details. And you really broke it down in that Twitter thread. It just felt like this great sense of completion for me.
Yeah, it's one of my inspiration. First of all, I thought that was a really gnarly bug. It was one of those where when I saw it, I can't really fully claim credit for it because I didn't hit it naturally. It was a customer that hit it, unfortunately, right? I just was able to tinker around within the lab and figure out what the root cause was and what the triggers were and such. But I remember when I was, you know, sitting, you know, in my queue back when we were in the office and just kind of talking out loud about it too. I mean, we're all sharing a tight knit cube space, right? And so we're just talking out loud about the various issues we see. And we're like, I'm like, is it this? Is it, I'm just talking out loud. No way. And I keep going over to my, you know, a teammate of mine and saying like, okay, it's not this, but it might be this. And I just keep, you know, going back and forth with them. I'm like, oh, I hit it. It's this. And it was like, you're never going to believe what this is, right? And so for those who haven't seen that thread or blog post, just a quick summary. Basically, if you have an MOTD banner with a delimiting character that is the letter Q, very odd delimiting character, and because it could very well be in the banner itself. And you also have a CLI alias configured where Q aliases to the exit command. Then when you copy run save, oh, and your configuration is long enough, you have enough configuration within your within the running config. And by enough, I mean like literal lines within the configuration. Then when you copy run start, it will pause and eventually time out after 10 minutes. So it's such a unique permutation or a unique combination of things where it's like, wow. And my inspiration behind like talking about that isn't just like, oh, cool, here's this cool bug I found, right? Because I found plenty of bugs. It's more of a imagine you're a software developer, right? And you're creating this software and these features for your customers. You can test a lot of stuff. Yourself with unit tests, integration tests. You could have a QA department dedicated to trying to reproduce these things before they come in the field. But until you create that feature and you release it to a customer and you watch them use it, you will never really fully understand it, the very unique ways that they use it, right? And that's just your feature.
Production. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is the Wild West out there, right? And when you combine that feature with a bunch of other features, because keep in mind, if I'm the MOTD banner dev, I'm probably have nothing to do with the CLI alias dev. You would never even think to test the interoperability, for lack of a better word, between those two, right? So my point is out there with putting that out there is software is hard. It really is. Like as a software developer, I would not say I'm qualified enough to be a software developer. But it seems like a really hard job to be able to create code that doesn't, that is bug free, so to speak.
Agreed.
So, yeah, yes.
I really like those posts because I subscribe to the Cisco notification service to get a bunch of bugs for stuff that's relevant. And I read some of those and I'm like, there's no way somebody hit all of these caveats in a row. And I'm like, well, wait, yeah, there has to be because they created this bug. So somebody had to hit it. I mean, some of those are just wild.
Yeah.
Yep. And it's worth noting that those are the bugs that you as a customer can see, right? There are tons of, I mean, like we obviously have a dedicated QA department. I've seen some wild stuff that they've found in between. And I would say that I wouldn't, you know, put a hard statistic on it, but I would say that the overwhelming majority of bugs that we find happen to be internal, meaning they're just within, you know, builds of the code that the customer would never see. Right. So, yeah, it's a crazy difficult job, and I am glad it is not mine. I've got the easy job or an easier job. I'll put it that way.
So let's step right into that. So, what do you do today, Christopher?
Yeah. So I recently took on, as of beginning of February, a new role in the United States Public Sector Department of Cisco, doing solution validation services, which is a very fancy word for saying we test a customer's or a copy or a lab of a customer's network and make sure that all of their technologies that they've deployed, the software they've deployed, the configuration they've deployed and stuff works as expected. And works is a very vague term. We can interpret that however we want. Sometimes the customer says, yeah, just, you know, make sure things don't explode, right? Or they have very specific requirements that they outline, like, you know, make sure latency doesn't exceed a certain amount, or make sure that during this failover, there's not a ton of packet loss, and ton is obviously quantified. And that sort of thing, which is it's a very interesting job as I'm learning, very different from my previous role, in the TAC. I had joined TAC beginning of 2018. I think that sounds right. Yeah. So I spent about, if you subtract training from it, probably about 2.5 years or so, closer to 3 years on the job. Taking cases and doing some other side projects and that kind of thing. And like I said before, that's supporting the Cisco Nexus data center product portfolio running InXOS. So if you are running ACI out there, fortunately, I guess for you, you never had to deal with it. Because I know nothing about ACI outside of some very basic stuff.
And so how are you settling into the new role? How is it very, very different than TAC?
Very different. It is a different kind of busy. I'll put it that way. I'm going to use the word slower paced, but that's not quite the right word, because it's not like that there's less work to do or anything along those lines. It's just that the urgency of that work is a little bit different. This is very much a longer project based type of role where you've got, you know, several weeks or sometimes even months to put together a solution for a customer and give them what they're looking for. Whereas in TAC, the projects are much, much shorter. Sometimes they're hours long.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
No, that makes sense. Interesting.
But yeah, I'm settling in. It's very different, but I'm learning a ton, both how to do the job as well as how to step away from the persona of a TAC engineer. There are lots of scenarios where you see it's like, oh man, I know what's wrong with that. Or I want to instantly hop into the troubleshooting mode and kind of dig deep into a problem, when it's like, dude, it's a Docker container. Just throw it and start over. You know what I mean? And
save yourself the 2 hours, please.
Are you finding it difficult to step out of the TAC engineer mind?
Yes and no. There are aspects of it that I want to keep that mindset, right? Or at least the mindset that I carried through TAC, where I'm on the lookout for things that a customer wouldn't enjoy about a product, whether it's like, hey, this documentation isn't very good, or it's wrong, which is obviously pretty bad, or just, you know, hey, I hit this snag. It would be nice if this was documented, or, you know, obviously straight up, you know, defects and that kind of thing in the product. That aspect of it, I like to keep. Just, I think that, you know, as somebody on the inside, so to speak, I have a kind of a duty to make sure that, you know, if I see something broken, I say something about it, right? Moving away from like the troubleshooting mindset is more of a personal time saver, if anything, just because, sure, I can spend 2-3 hours trying to dive deep into something and trying to figure out and revert it. And literally this happened today. Well, no, I saved myself today. It did happen yesterday, where I spent 3 or 4 hours trying to get this, you know, a product to deploy. And because I had messed up the configuration, it wasn't deploying properly, and I was trying to get it to like revert halfway back. And it wasn't until I had finally fixed it where I realized, wait a minute, I was doing all of this within a Docker container. I could have just like literally just exited the Docker container and restarted it, and everything would have been fine, right? And I was like, okay, maybe I need to pivot a little bit sooner, maybe with it. And so a friend of mine who has very similar problems, we both agreed 5 minutes. 5 minutes is the rule before I start saying, okay, let's step away from it and not waste a bunch of time trying to figure out what went wrong.
Wow. 5 minutes, huh? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which sounds kind of aggressive, but it's like, I mean, if I'm going to waste 3 or 4 hours on something, you know, I like to think my time is valuable. Everybody should think their time is valuable.
Yes, absolutely. That ties back to our something else we're releasing soon, I think. Yeah. No, something we've released just recently, one of our episodes on salary negotiation, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm thinking through that as I know I probably can't count the amount of times that I stick with something a lot longer than I should just because I'm freaking stubborn sometimes. But yeah, you got to know when to cut the
losses.
You
think you're almost there. Yeah. And you like you play whack-a-mole with problems sometimes, right? Where definitely. It's like you think you're right at the end. It's like, if I solve this one, it'll definitely work after that. And then you hit the next problem and you repeat that about 20 times or however many. And then you're like, you know what? Maybe I should back out of this entirely.
Wow.
So I want to, I want to dig into the tech experience more often. I'd like to talk about your new role, but I know it's new, so we might not have a whole lot yet, but definitely want to dig into the tech role. But before we do that, do you mind kind of throwing it back for us to what kind of got you into technology? What got you where you are today?
Mm-hmm. So I like to say that I got into technology when I was like 3 or 4 years old. Both of my parents met online, and for reference, I was born in 1995. So that was a very primitive online back then. They met in a very ancient version of a chat room. I'm thinking it was like even before IRC. They both had Commodore 64s. That's how they met and got together. And then they,
I'm sorry. I've got the dial up sound stuck in my head right now too, that they had to hear so they could talk to each other.
So when I started in tech, when I was, you know, 3 or 4, the main thing that got me going was, they'd throw me and have me playing some video games. So like, I remember being scared of Doom because, you know, I'm 3. So I preferred to play like EverQuest. They were both big EverQuest fans back then. There was an old game called Star Siege Tribes, what I have put thousands of hours into at this point, probably starting at age 3 all the way up to probably 14, 15. Just video games, right? And in even playing quote unquote online with people, I didn't really understand the concept of talking to people over, you know, that I couldn't physically see in front of me. But in order to play online, you got to have dial up. And so one of the first things they taught me was how to get online with dial. So despite being born in 95 towards the end of that dial up era, I know that dial up sound very, very well.
Parents sound awesome. Well. My parents were doing the opposite. They didn't want me to know
how to. that's where I like to say I started, right? Just getting experience with computers and that kind of thing. So it was starting with like IT itself. In like middle school and high school, I was very much the typical nerdy kid, right? So I was the guy who was, you know, always kind of tweaking his computer and fixing my friend's computers for $20 and, you know, that kind of thing. Accidentally installing, you know, viruses on my computer and then figuring out how to get rid of them and without my parents ever knowing, because that would be terrible. It was a shared family computer, so it made it even worse, right? Thanks. At least if I have my own computer, like, you know, I can mess it up to my own content. But shared family computer, they will get pretty mad if I, you know, utterly trash it.
Understandable.
So that experience really helped, like, get me started, right, with learning how do computers really work, how does the operating system work, that kind of thing. Just, you know, figuring out how to remove malware on a computer, right?
So, was a bulk of this on your own, or were there any programs in middle school and high school that helped you?
Middle school, no. In high school, yes. But a lot of it was just Google, man. You just figure it out, right? You say you've got the worst possible time table. You're like, all right, well, you know, my parents are home in 3 hours from work. I got to figure out how to fix this thing, right? And then the other aspect of it is like trying to, you know, push the limits of the computer and be like, oh, I made a tweet the other day joking about, you know, disabling unnecessary services on Windows from starting up with Windows so you can, you know, squeeze out an extra bit of processor performance or something like that. And this is not way back in the days when that stuff mattered. This is like, we're talking like 2005, right? When it's like, no, you're not going to get, like, sorry, that's not going to let you play World of Warcraft without a video card or something like that, right? It's not going to help. But just like getting familiar with that kind of thing and be like, what is a service in Windows? Why is that important? What are all these processes? What's Task Manager? Just that general, like, investigating that sort of thing at a relatively young age got me started, right? And especially once, you know, in middle school and high school, I had started fixing other people's computers for money. I was thinking like, oh, like this is I can make money doing this. I like money.
That's how started. We all think now.
yeah. There were programs in high school that absolutely helped me out though, because they a lot of the stuff that I had learned on my own was very just little bits and pieces of knowledge here. But having like a formal course that was like, okay, this is like actually what a processor is. This is what a Hertz is and what's going on with math behind the scenes. And this is, you know, memory and all this. Having that program that connected those bits of logic together helped out quite a bit.
You might be too young, but I have to ask, did you ever like have LAN parties?
Yes, a few times. Not very often, like, because as the nerdy kid in middle school and high school, didn't have that many friends. But
really,
every once in a while, yeah. Oh.
I was in band. Okay, this is where this question's coming from. And we were all nerdy, and we were all nerdy, and we had massive LAN parties at this one guy's house. Anyway.
Yeah, we had, there were a few, just a few, like, okay, we'll get together and do three or four. When I think LAN party, I'm thinking like, you know, 10, 20 people or so. And there was only like one or two that I can think of where we did that, which were, you know, really, really fun. But no, it was a lot of it was just like, oh yeah, I've got a handful of friends that happen to play the same video game. So maybe we'll meet up and play in every once in a while. It's funny you mentioned it. I was a chorus kid actually in high school. So mortal enemies.
I was gonna say arch nemesis.
Now the tell-all secrets are coming out.
I knew there had to be something wrong with you.
I was gonna say everybody in band was weird to me except for what is it called? The percussion section.
Yeah,
it's like drum percussion. Core, whatever they're called. Those kids were always really cool.
They were always the cool ones.
Drumline, there we go. Yes.
Yeah, drumline's all. Percussion section is always the chill ones.
Yeah.
Sometimes, but yeah, saxophones as well. All right, we're done talking about band. I'm so sorry. I wanted to know if you like did the LAN thing.
That's some high school drama.
Because that was the okay. Yeah, right.
Don't.
Yeah, LAN parties are the one thing that, you know, maybe high school kids just do without realizing they're learning. I don't know.
Yeah.
Don't cut out the band bit, Dan. We need to keep that in the show.
Hey, y'all. It's Lexi, aka Track It Pacer, or as my most recent burner account hater described me, quote, "She can't configure a switch for shit." I'm really sorry to interrupt you in the middle of the podcast, but I have a cool story to tell you, and it'll only take a minute, and then we'll get back to the show, okay? So I come from a NOC background. I started out in a NOC, and the most annoying thing that would happen back then is when a user would come in complaining about a problem, blaming the network, but our network monitoring system was showing zero signs that anything was wrong. And suspend your disbelief for just a moment, and we're assuming that the network actually is at fault. Okay. Sadly, most network monitoring software really only pings devices and shows you utilization on maybe a few interfaces, but overall, this doesn't really help us in the end. What if you knew everything that your network equipment knows? Like everything. Path Solutions actually has a product that does this, and it's called TotalView. It provides automated root cause troubleshooting of the entire network. I'm talking monitoring every interface on every switch, router, gateway, and firewall. It also goes deep, collecting performance data, 19 different error counters, QoS, CDP, LLDP, and PoE on every interface, the whole kit and caboodle. TotalView is also smart. It has a built-in heuristics engine that analyzes the information to provide you, the user, with plain English root cause resolutions to problems that other NMS systems really wouldn't even be aware of. You're responsible for the entire network, right? So shouldn't you have visibility that matches your responsibility? Visit PathSolutions.com today to learn more about TotalView and get total network visibility on your network. Now back to the show.
So what did post-high school look like for you?
So post-high school, my family was relatively poor going up. We were stuck in the awkward like poverty range where it's like you are in America where you're too poor for benefits, but you don't make enough to really like actually kind of sort of make ends meet. So a lot through high school, I worked as a, I don't really know what the title would be, an assistant, something like that, in a local nursery, a plant nursery. So I was, a lot of my days after school were out working with, you know, landscaping, not landscaping, but like, you know, watering plants, helping people carry stuff to their car and load stuff and that kind of thing. That was all fine and good until I graduated high school and I went to a local community college for probably a semester or two. And I realized money doesn't come from nowhere. Having that extra money when you're in high school is really nice, but then you start kind of getting saddled with responsibilities and you've got student debts that you need to start paying off and, you know, textbook stuff. And it's like, okay, well, I'm hungry at school and I don't have any lunch. Like I need to get some income to start paying for the stuff, right? I'll preface all of this by saying I'm incredibly lucky, like, you know, like really, really lucky, almost undeservingly lucky. Where we lived, there was a like a local computer store, probably about like half a mile, maybe a mile away from where we lived. Think like computer repair and that sort of thing, although they sold like individual parts and that kind of thing. And so I, on a whim, it was just some winter day in like December, something like that. I walked over, filled out an application and, you know, walked away. And they called me back for an interview a few days later or something like that. And they had said like, hey, you did like really well. They had like a test or something like that they give you to kind of filter out like, you know, people who think they know IT, but don't really, and that sort of thing. And that sounds a little gatekeepy, but it's kind of like,
no,
it
sounds like your first tech interview, to be honest.
Yes, yeah, in a way it was. And it was just like, hey, you know, fill out this questionnaire with, you know, the best answers you got. And, you know, we'll come back to you with your information. And we'll come back to you if you, if we think you qualify. And they had said, yeah, you basically like knocked it out of the park with this test when they called me back. I was like, oh, okay. I was like, does that mean I have a job? And they're like, yep.
Nice.
So I started there, and this was before I didn't have a car or anything like that. So for the first probably like 6 or 9 months or so, I just walked the mile, which was either actually kind of nice. And you know, put in my time there. And that was where a lot of the experience that I had gotten from middle school and high school like really started clicking, because I got to see a wide variety of problems. And I got to deal with customers in IT, and I got to learn
that's
it's
part
like a combination.
Of IT.
You get to learn the delicate balance of like dealing with customers in from an IT perspective, as well as like the retail perspective, right? So I got a little bit of the best of both worlds there, the absolute best. That was, I think I did that for about a year and a half or so. And that was looking back, like a really fun experience, because, you know, I got to fix computers all day. I'm 18 years old, 19 years old. People bring me their computers. I fix them. I figure out what's wrong with them. Sometimes it's some, you know, really basic stuff. Sometimes it's, you know, kind of gnarly and you just can't figure it out. Right. That was a really crucial, like entry level step, I think, for me. As with all entry level jobs, pay wasn't great. I mean, it was at the end of the day, it was still like a retail job. But just having the opportunity to talk tech with sometimes, you know, the ordinary Joe who walks in with a computer problem, sometimes it's, you know, a quote unquote fellow nerd who comes in and wants to buy a new processor or something like that. And being able to talk like, oh yeah, here's the, you know, this one's pretty good. So like for your budget range, you probably want this. Like, I was living the dream back then. It was a lot of fun.
Awesome. Okay. So going into, you said you took a few courses at a community college. Did you go to university? Mm-hmm. What did you end up doing after, you know, after that job?
My journey in academia is a sad story.
Oh, I'm sorry. You don't have to.
So you know. It's not sad like a I'm emotional sad, more of a you learn a lot when you're young, right? So when I went to community college initially, I wanted to do, I thought I wanted to do computer science. So I thought that I wanted to go to North Carolina State University. I'm based in North Carolina, which has a really good engineering and computer science program. I wanted to do that out of high school, but because I decided to prioritize video games after school instead of homework and doing what I wanted instead of what was good for my academic career, my grades weren't up to snuff for that. What's a kid to do? Community college, right? It's cheap. It'll get you going, right? So I did that for 2 years. I got my Associates of Science because I thought that I wanted to transfer into NC State. And they did not accept me because, surprise, surprise, I didn't learn my lesson from high school. It turns out that even in college, you need to prioritize studies in order to do well in life. So NC State wouldn't take me. I said, okay, well, what else can I do with this, right? I still need to move, up. Still want to do something related to technology, IT, computer science, something along those lines. And I was a little bit turned off from programming from previous experiences where I had tried and didn't really learn. And I was like, I really like the whole fixing computers aspect of this. I want to see if I can do something with that instead of computer science, which is obviously much more programming heavy. So I looked at another university nearby, East Carolina University, and they had a really good IT program. Something my high school teacher had told, one of my high school teachers had told me was that ECU in North Carolina, for those who don't know, there's a lot of rivalry between colleges. So we'll all riff on each other, right? I think that teacher who was from UNC said, oh, ECU, they take anybody with a beating heart. I have a beating heart, actually. So they did accept my application. But for the IT, the specific IT program that I wanted to go into, I needed an Associates of Applied Science. I had an Associates of Science.
What is the difference?
I don't know to this day.
I'm glad that's the answer because I was sweating over here going, I'm not going to say I don't know what it is.
The Associates of Applied Science is has a little bit more focus on IT specific stuff. There was a specific pipeline to get into this bachelor's program that I wanted to get into for IT, and I did not follow that pipeline. I just carried on with my normal generic 2-year associate's degree and thought that would do it for me. The sad part is, the kind of emotional sad part is, East Carolina accepted my application and I thought I was good to go until my first meeting with my advisor. And they said, oh, this isn't going to work.
Wow.
You don't have any of the prerequisites for this bachelor's. And I was like, what do you mean? I'm like, you have the wrong degree. We shouldn't even have even accepted you. And I was like, oh, so to make a long story short, I got punted back to community college for another 2 years to get my Associates of Applied Science.
No way. And you stuck with
That's
it.
That's when you have to say no takes
and
backsies.
I stuck with it.
You can't send me away. You already accepted me. It's over. God, that sucks. I'm sorry. But you did it. You did it.
I did it. And it was actually, while the path sounds like it sucks, and it kind of did for a while, I don't think I would change it. And here's why. While I was doing my Associates of Applied Science, a really weird sounding company by the name of Cisco happened to do a recruiting event. And literally on a whim, I didn't see it ahead of time and plan for it. I think I saw it the day of or maybe the night before. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll go do that. This was after I had left my job at the computer repair place. I did a little bit of consulting for a very, very small managed services provider in the meantime, doing micro business IT consulting for dentist offices. And we had a warehouse customer and just a bunch of different types of businesses. So just on a whim, I went to this event. And gave him my resume and talked to him. And this was for a co-op position in their lab. They, at the time, they called it CALO. I think that's Customer Advocacy Lab Operations. They've rebranded now. for a co-op position where I would basically just be helping out tech engineers and consulting engineers and that kind of thing with creating smaller live replicas of customers' networks. And I was like, yeah, sure, that sounds neat. I mean, it's Cisco, right? You know, if you want to do IT, you've heard of Cisco. So sure, I'll show up and talk to them and see what's up. And they signed me up for an interview that day.
Oh, wow.
I guess they saw my resume and was like, oh, you've had experience for like 2.5 years at this point. Like, yeah, let's get you on board. Right. So I want to say that was probably mid or late 2016. And then I started as a co-op in 2017, doing lab stuff for, Cisco.
How was that? That sounds like it'd be fun.
It was a lot of fun. Like looking back on it, it was a lot of fun doing the work itself. I'll never forget like the first day that I walked into the lab, right? Which is half of a floor's worth of just racks and racks and racks of equipment. Most of it's Cisco. Basically every single product that they had manufactured that does routing, switching, I mean, everything, honestly, they just didn't have like collaboration stuff in that specific lab. Everything that they've made for the past like 20 years.
Wow.
Was all in there. Yeah. And it's just like, and you walk in and just it's a data center essentially, and the noise just overwhelms you, and you've just, you know, the screaming of the fans, and it's like a little bit hot, and you're like, oh, okay. And you're just walking through like row after row after row of racks full of equipment. And me being an IT student who hadn't really done, again, this sounds kind of gatekeepy, but like real IT, because I was doing consulting for very small businesses, like 10, 20 employee businesses where, you know, we buy Netgear switches, right? And we throw them in there, right? It's very much a get the job done kind of business. To walk into this was, I wouldn't even call it a data center now because it's not really a data center. I thought this was a data center and I was like, this is cool. This is what I want to do. I want to touch this stuff. This is cool. So I was basically infatuated with it as soon as I walked in. I was like, yeah, I mean, you get to play with all of this stuff. I get to cable it up for people. I mean, yeah, sign me up. Absolutely. Once I got into the job, it was, I don't want to say monotonous. I don't want to say like that to discredit it. But it comes down to like, okay, load this version of go find this router, this model router and this model switch and connect them in this way and load this software on there. And then, you know, make sure your connections are up and there you go. We only handled the physical layer aspect of it, making sure that those links were up. We didn't do very much in the way of configuring those devices or actually mimicking the customer's network. And that makes total logical sense. Because you don't want the college co-op to be bringing up a mimicked topology of an MPLS L3 VPN, right? Because these are two very different things.
The skill set's not quite there. If you can do it, sure, but chances are pretty good that you know you don't have the skill set there, right?
Wow. So okay, that's pretty neat. So how did you progress then from that position onward? Was it from there you moved into tech?
Yes. Okay. Cisco has a very good pipeline for college graduates. For people in college, you can get a co-op position and do a lot of cool stuff. There's lots of intern opportunities there. There's also a very good pipeline to get college graduates into either TAC or our professional services organization. Just kind of depends on your skill set and your personal preference. As a co-op, I was working very closely with a lot of TAC engineers from a lot of different product lines. And you start to get an idea of like, okay, I like the Nexus stuff. That stuff's really cool. You know, of course I walk into this lab and I'm like, this is a data center. So I'm like, of course I'm inclined to go for the data center stuff, right? Cause I think that's cool.
Yeah.
But you're like, oh, I like the Nexus stuff. I like how stuff, let me, you know, get closer with the data center team. And let me, in a way, cherry pick a lot of the cases that they're opening with us to ask them to ask us to cable up certain things with them, right? So after getting a little bit closer with them and working with the team a little bit more, I said, okay, this is the team that I want to go to, right? A number of the engineers on that team liked me so much, I guess, or thought my work was of sufficient quality or whatever, that they would kind of clue me in and be like, oh, this is what we're trying to recreate for this. Or they would, you know, help me work with the topology a little bit more than was expected of us, right?
Man, those people are the best people.
They
whenever
really
you
are.
Encounter yeah. them, they really are. Yeah.
Yes, and I, as I move up in my career, I'm trying to always look for opportunities to reach back down the ladder and pull people up with me, right? Because that's how I got to where I am. You ask any of them, they'll say, "Oh, you know, with your skill set, you probably would have been fine, whatever." But that's just it's just not the case, right? You need to find people. You don't need to, but it makes it a lot easier if you find those people and they are able to help bring you up with them. But yeah, I got close with them, and then they heavily encouraged me to not only go through that new college grad pipeline, but also handpicked me and said, "I want this person on my team." So they said, "You're coming to this team. You're already familiar with the product line. We already know who you are. We know you're, you know, a decent human being. Come join us specifically, right?"
That's gotta
feel
good. So
that happened, and
that's awesome.
It always feels great when you are handpicked to. When you're basically groomed and handpicked to come to a specific team,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Fast forward to now, I suppose, after my time.
Wow.
I did my time in the time.
Yeah, you did. You've just like moved on up. That's a really cool story. And it's, yeah. I really love, you know, I went to college, but I, you know, didn't get a degree in anything STEM. And so I feel like I can relate when it's sort of like a, I don't know. Do we still consider it like non-traditional for people to like, you know, be working in networking, but not have gotten a degree in it or something? Like, I don't really know if that's real. I feel like that's more the norm these days than anything else, to be honest. But
I don't know. I almost want to say that it is becoming more of an expectation that people have college degrees.
Really?
I think so. I think if we were to go back like 10 or so years or so, it would be like you would see more people without degrees than people with. And this is do you get the degree or not to get the degree? What a topic, right?
Like, we don't need to get, we don't have to have that conversation here. That's a huge.
My take on that whole thing is it helps out a lot to have a college degree. So something I'll mention is that when I eventually got my Associates of Applied Science, because there's a difference apparently, and went to ECU, I did all my classes virtually. So the entire rest of my bachelor's was all done virtually. Because I was already, at that point, I was already a co-op. When I applied to ECU, I was a tech engineer. So I was doing college virtually in the evenings and then somehow learning what a Nexus is during the day.
Wow.
Still don't know, by the way. And so technically, I didn't have a bachelor's degree when I was in tech. And one of the things that I was wondering, because doing college when you already have a full-time job, and tech is a demanding job. You ask any support engineer and they will tell you that. That was a lot. That was quite a bit. And I'll be honest, I probably don't deserve that bachelor's degree because I did not put in a ton of work in order to get that. Just because by the time the evenings rolled around or the weekends rolled around, I was so tired. Like, you know, I did not have the energy for it. So I somehow got it, but I probably did not put in as much energy as it deserves. One thing that I had contemplated and had talked with a few people within TAC about it, including managers and, you know, upper leadership, was, do I keep going for my bachelor's? Is there actually going to be any value if I keep doing it? And a lot of people said, we know you, you're a really good person, hard worker, whatever. You'll probably do fine without it. You should probably get it. because they all said, I don't want you to not be able to get a position higher up in this company because you don't have it. That would just suck. If you suddenly hit a ceiling where it's like, no, sorry, you can't go any higher than this because you just don't have a four-year degree. And especially in a larger corporation, that could very well be a reality, right? So I said, fine. And I kept going for it.
I'm just curious how long it took you to, once you were working at Cisco and taking the courses, how long did it take you to complete it?
I did it in the 2 years.
2 years.
I think it was a 2 year spin. Yeah. Okay. I have been, as a result of my, as you can probably imagine, as a result of my entire academic career, I am burnt out on academia. Maybe that attitude will change in like 5 or 10 years. Because I know some people have said, you know, oh, you should consider a master's or something like that. There's a number of people in this industry that I respect quite a bit who have a doctorate. And Doctor of Art really has a nice ring to it. But for now, I can't do it. It's just I don't have it in me just yet. There's so much else that I can do that I want to do before I make that a goal. But I would say, you know, to anybody up and coming, I would say if you're considering like, oh, do I get a certification or do I go for my college degree or something like that? I would say both. Try to do both. But I would say go for the bachelor's degree because from what I've seen, that's becoming more and more of a hard requirement where they just won't let you in if you don't have one. Doesn't matter if you're God's gift to IT, you don't get in.
Interesting. So what kinds of bachelor, what flavors of degrees should people be potentially looking at, do you think?
That's a good question.
Like, you know, mine is in English literature. So like, obviously not
so,
that.
Yeah. Right? Well, so you say that, but I actually disagree. I think really? That if you have a bachelor's of any kind, then you could... Like that qualifies you. So I've seen people who've transitioned careers, similarly to yourself, that just because if they have a bachelor's of anything, that is good enough, right?
Well, that makes me feel better for sure.
Yeah.
But that's
good. I would say bachelor's of IT, I think that the academic world has a little bit of work to do to figure out what that means before that has any real weight to it compared to a bachelor's of computer science or something along those lines. Now, granted, that was my attitude when I was going through college. Things have changed the past few years. There's a number of schools out there. The one that really comes to mind is, what is it called? WGU, Western Governors University. It's like a total, I think it's all online. And I've known a few people who have gone through that. Same. Really, really good school. I think RIT up in New York is another one. I don't know if they're all online, but I've seen some really good people come out of that school. And I think that they're an IT focused school, or one of their programs is IT focused. And I mean, they train you and you know your stuff.
Heard really good things about them. Yeah.
But I've heard a number of other people who have an opinion of bachelor's of IT doesn't mean anything, like because IT itself is such a huge range of possible careers. What could that possibly mean? Even like a bachelor's of science in IT security is so vague that what do you actually know as a result of that, right? So yeah.
When I was,
if anybody wonders, mine is a bachelor's of. Technically a bachelor's of IT. I think the full title is Bachelor's of Industrial Technology with a concentration in information technology, something like
that. Industrial technology.
Because the way ECU, they roped that in, I think, with like a few other different kinds of engineering, like textiles or something along those lines. There were different verticals under that department that offered that. But it's a bachelor's of science for IT is basically what it is.
Cool. So did you study a lot of different, like I took some community college courses in 2018 when I started over, right? And I only got as far as like one and a half semesters. But the courses I took for that first semester of, I think it was an associate's in information technology, right? The courses that I was required to take were introduction to programming, introduction to computers, which is like, this is how Excel works, and then introduction to networking. So those are all like very broad. That's like a very broad spread. I feel like you basically have like computer science and then you have network engineering sort of, and whatever intro to computers was like, that's all very different.
So my associates, the Associates of Applied Science was basically the Cisco NetAcad course spread out across like four courses or whatever.
Okay.
Yeah. I think there was, no, that wasn't in that one. There were some computer science-y ones like, oh, here's Java. Here's, I think C, either C or C++ was one of them. And then there were a few others. I think there was like a databases one. It's just entry level stuff of a few different verticals within IT just to get you started. And then the bachelor's was the same thing except at the intermediate level. So like CCMP level courses, through NetAcad, There were a handful of Linux courses that I took in both degrees, now that I think about it. But I think the ECU courses were more Red Hat oriented through I think Red Hat has a curriculum. I think there was another databases one. There was a storage one, which I thought was interesting because now I know what flogging means. That's about all I know about storage. I did not like that class.
I was like, why aren't you just doing Ethernet? Ethernet works. We know it. We know what Ethernet is. It's kind of even those classes you can see are kind of spread out amongst multiple different disciplines, which on one hand means, oh, well, you're not specialized. So, you know, what do you know? But on the other hand, kind of know like a little bit of everything, right? So I can choose, you know, obviously you can choose what courses you want. So if you like the networking, then you can take the networking specifically. But you still kind of are forced into doing a little bit of Linux and a little bit of programming and this and that, and you widen your experience. And that's super helpful in the real world, I think. Even within TAC, I can't tell you, VMware classes is another example that I just thought of. Wow. I have solved a number of VMware attack cases. I don't work for VMware. they called into Cisco and the ESXi host connects to the Nexus and they had some issue with it. So I said, well, show me the ESXi host. I'm not scared of VMware. You know, just because it doesn't have Cisco on the label doesn't mean I'm here to solve your issue, right? And figured out, oh yeah, misconfigured subnet mask or, you know, whatever the case might be. So having that breadth of experience can help out even when you choose to specialize in one specific thing like networking.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't tell you how many times I wish that I had, you know, taken a broader, you know, I don't know, broader discipline.
Yeah, I think it definitely helps you open your eyes. And that's why I think we're all kind of big proponents of when you're starting out, don't necessarily shy away from the service desk, the help desk, the desktop support, because it really helps broaden your horizons to different things. There is one thing that I wanted to highlight, Christopher, and it's that the school that has the mascot of a pirate told you that you didn't have the right degree to get in the first time around. But just kidding, ECU, go Pirates. But do you mind?
Despite the fact as a teenager that I had pirated a lot of content by then, it's really weird. Like, it doesn't make any sense. I'm the perfect head.
So do you mind? You talked about the tech engineer position being high paced, being exhausting. Do you mind kind of unpacking the whole experience? You don't have to get into individual cases unless you got some juicy ones that you don't mind sharing. But I just kind of want to know, how did you psych yourself up for that role? Did you know what you were getting into? What was it like?
Mm-hmm. Because I had had the co-op experience and was able to get very close with a lot of these TAC engineers, it got to the point where I was shadowing some of them on cases during my lunch breaks as a co-op, where I would just be like, hey, what you working on? And, you know, they'd be on a call or something along those lines. So I knew what I was getting into, right? So I was mentally prepared to get into that, right? It's a difficult job, I'll put it that way. If there was a Greek god of IT and I was somehow chosen to be it, and I was omnipotent, omniscient, and everything, and I just had my way, I would make everybody in IT work two jobs. The first one would be outside of IT. It'd be retail or food service, because everybody should work one of those jobs. The second would be working as a support team for a vendor, wherein that vendor owns that solution or that product or something along those lines, meaning the buck stops with you. If a customer opens up a case with you, you are responsible for figuring out that solution. You will learn more about how that product, that solution, and how that vertical in IT, whether it's networking or security or whatever, you will learn how that stuff really works outside of what you might learn in a certification, outside of even what you might work as if you were a customer in that case, if you were in a managed service provider or a partner or whatever the case is. Because until you're put in that situation, that high pressure situation where the buck stops with you and you have to have the answer, even if you don't necessarily know not only the answer, but even how to get to the answer, that you'll learn a lot through that experience. I would not trade my time in TAC for anything. I think it is, like, more than anything else in my career, I think it is responsible for propelling me forward and my knowledge of networking forward.
Did it help you? Did it help you like develop a process for troubleshooting? Like a
yes. Oh yes.
You know
oh,
I'm talking. Yes. Yeah, like a troubleshooting yes. stack, basically.
One day I want to write a book on that. Yeah. I'll put it that way, because there is definitely like a very problem or platform or technology independent method for troubleshooting a problem that I think a lot of people go through and they don't realize it, or they never go through it and they never realize that there is a process, right? a lot of people that I've a lot of I want to be careful here because I don't want to insinuate that customers are bad at troubleshooting or that anybody is bad at troubleshooting, right? Because I've been put through my experiences in a unique position where, because the buck stops here, I've gotten to see a large number of different problems and had to figure out how to troubleshoot them, right? A lot of people have a troubleshooting approach that I like to call darts at a dartboard. They're given a problem and they say, all right, well, let me try this. All right, let me try this. There's not much rhyme or reason to it. A lot of it is just kind of based on past experiences where it's like, well, I tried this one time and it solved some other problem. So let me try it now. I'm going to try this. They don't really analytically tackle the actual problem itself. Something that I like to tell a lot of junior engineers going into TAC is that as a TAC engineer, you're not actually like, you might think you're a TAC engineer. You're not actually a TAC engineer. You're something else. That something else varies. In this case, you're a lawyer. You have quite literally a support case. You have a problem put in front of you and a series of facts and or evidence supporting that problem. And it is your job to go through and make sure that all of that evidence is true, is factual, and actually corresponds with the problem and how that corresponds with the symptoms the customer is seeing. And you need to be able to prove without a shadow of a doubt that all of that evidence matches, such that a specific root cause for a problem is like undeniably, like I said, without a shadow of a doubt, that is the root cause, right? And there have been so many times where I think it was like John Adams who said that facts are inconvenient things, they're fickle things, they don't go away, right? There have been so many times where I've thought that the root cause of a problem is something, and I have like 9 different pieces of evidence that all point to that one thing. But there is one other piece of evidence where it's like, that just doesn't, it does not fit into the puzzle. It just doesn't fit. So it can't be that. And you have to kind of go back and reanalyze everything and do some more research and do some more testing and try and figure out what that missing piece is and figure out what you're missing. There's a bit of a mind game that goes on there too.
I can imagine just one big puzzle. Wow. Yeah. I'm TAC sounds like the ultimate place to learn how to troubleshoot for sure. Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And under pressure.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you're definitely under pressure because I think, like I said before, sometimes you need to solve these things in a matter of hours. Sometimes it's days, sometimes it's months. I want to say the oldest case I ever had, don't know if it was it wasn't start to finish for sure, but the oldest case I ever closed was 2 years old.
Wow.
Was it like fairly active? Like, were there updates on it? Like, relatively?
Yes, there were pauses, like multi-month pauses because we're pending some action or something along those lines. So that kind of, you know, it's a little bit of an inflated number, but still, it is what it is.
Wow.
And I would say in those scenarios, props to the customers, honestly, because not only are they having to deal with the actual issue, but they're, for lack of a better word, putting up with the process, the support process, and the rigorous finite state machine of finally getting down to what the root cause of a problem is.
Hey, A1 fans, AJ here for NetAlly. Never heard of NetAlly? Sure you have. They came from the same group of engineers that brought us network tools from Fluke Networks, NetScout, and now they're NetAlly. They know networking. I'm a network engineer for a partner, and when I go to customers and see they use NetAlly, I know it's going to be so much easier to troubleshoot issues we might run into. The name may have changed to NetAlly, but the way they build tools hasn't changed a bit. They ask, what would a network engineer want to help make their job faster and easier? And then they go build it, just like this Etherscope NXG. NetAlly is here to help. NetAlly, simplicity, visibility, collaboration. Visit netally.com today. Now back to the show.
I'd like to get your thoughts on handling pressure and maybe some advice, because us in the enterprise space, you know, we hopefully don't have to deal with those downtime bridges that we got to be on, people looking over your shoulder all the time. We hope to not have to deal with those too often. You could be dealing with those in TAC on a daily basis with a bunch of different customers. So what are your thoughts? What's your advice on folks handling that stress and still being able to function?
Yes. So what I've told a number of customers is that whenever they're in that kind of high pressure outage situation is basically exactly what you said. I tell them, this is probably the worst outage you've had in the past 6 months, in the past year, 2 years. For me, this is a Tuesday.
I love that.
Like this is what I do every single day, right? As something that I preach to all of the engineers that I've trained is a sense of ownership, right? And there's a sense of ownership and a sense of presence when you're on a call. When you're I like to think, especially coming from Cisco, the reason why customers tend to choose Cisco is the sense of ownership that a tech engineer can have when they're driving a multi-vendor call or any call really. But when you get a good engineer, you can tell because they take control of the call. Doesn't matter if there's five people in it, one person, 10, 50, 200. It doesn't really matter, right? They are driving the troubleshooting. They're driving the analysis of a problem from start to finish. They're getting the facts out of people. And sometimes they have to do the very uncomfortable thing where they have to hold a customer to the wall and say, I need you this information and I need you to make sure that it's accurate because this is going to skew our troubleshooting for the next hour, 2 hour, 3 hours. And your business is down and you're losing money as we speak. So I need you to make sure that this is accurate. So sometimes, and I'll admit this readily, sometimes I've been stern, for lack of a better word, with a customer who has tried to distract the troubleshooting to go look at some other problem that seems unrelated or something along those lines, or we'll be troubleshooting like a specific traffic flow that's broken, and they'll say, oh, well, here's another flow that's broken. And I'll say, no, we're going to focus on this one flow and we're going to trace it all the way through and we're going to isolate it. We're going to figure out what's going on, because chances are pretty good if we fix this one flow, we're going to fix all 10,000 of the other broken flows, right? And if we don't, that's fine. We'll troubleshoot the ones that are still broken afterwards, right? But sometimes you have to be very stern and really own and drive that issue to its total completion. And in my opinion, that includes when other vendors need to troubleshoot something. So I've been on troubleshooting calls with VMware, with Dell, with Arista, that sort of thing, where even if they're troubleshooting their box, I am still actively engaged in the troubleshooting process. So I'm still giving them the facts as I know it. If they ask questions, I'll try to respond with the answers as I know it. I'm there. Ultimately, I'm there to solve the problem. Sometimes that problem is Cisco's fault. Sometimes it's somebody else's fault. I don't really care. I just want the problem solved permanently, not like, oh, let's reload the switch and hope it goes away kind of thing.
So I've heard a lot of people in my time complain about providing show techs to TAC. And I just want to ask you straight from the horse's mouth. I've been given the answer before, but I think it'd be fun to ask anyway. Why do we need to provide show techs with every TAC case that we open?
Excellent question. I don't want to say every single TAC case.
Okay.
But well, I would say most TAC cases, please do open them with a show tech, because for a few different reasons. One, being able to see that information from a single device gives me an idea as to obviously what that device's configuration is, but also the general health of that device at that current point in time, as well as, depending on the product, some point in time in the past. So it helps give me a little bit of context behind how the device is feeling, for lack of a better word, at that moment in time.
So a show tech is a collection of commands, essentially, right?
Usually a large bundle of a bunch of different commands. And the important part is that it's a selection of commands that are going to be important to both me as a TAC engineer, as well as to Cisco's engineering, if we ever get up to that level, right? So it's just a general good snapshot of, we'll just, you know, grab that and we'll get an idea as to where the box is at. So the next question is probably like, okay, well, if you're just looking at, you know, the log and the config and CPU utilization, why can't I just run those commands and give them to you? trying to think of a way to say this as nicely as possible. No, there's actually a really good way I can say this. If you give me some arbitrary problem, I can probably tell you 5, 6, 7, 10 commands that I could use to troubleshoot that off the top of my head. What I can't tell you is what commands I'll need to look at after those 10 commands. So usually a show tech will give me that ability. Oh, the CPU, you know, just using an arbitrary example, this interface is down. Why is this interface down? We can go look at the log. Okay. And then based on the error in that, we can look at a specific log from a specific process and so on and so forth. You can do that, that sort of recursive investigation within a single file from a single device, and it's all there for you, right? As opposed to, okay, you know, show run and show interface. Cool. I can see this interface is down. Hey, can you get me the CPU utilization? Oh, look, it's this process. Oh, you know, and it saves some back and forth. Is it going to save all of the back and forth? Depends on the problem. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Is it going to save some back and forth? Most of the time, yes. It also helps out a lot when engineers, when ownership of a case moves from one engineer to another. I always really, really liked it when there was a set of show techs from a bunch of different devices in a case that I took ownership from somebody else, because then I can look at those ahead of time without having to ask the customer to grab them for me. Because that can also be a frustrating experience from a customer's point of view, where it's like, okay, well, you're the second or third person I've worked with. Why are we just now asking for these show techs? And I know some people listening will be like, oh, well, TAC has done that to me before, where they've asked for a fresh set of show techs. And yes, that happens. And I would say I've done it myself, not because I didn't look at previous show techs, but because I looked at them and I wanted to see a fresh snapshot of the issue, because the issue has evolved since the case was initially opened. So I want to get another fresh snapshot just so I can reestablish my context with the issue.
Makes sense.
So it's a long form answer. There's not a simple answer, unfortunately. The real solution to this problem, the real networking nirvana we should all hope and pray for, is a scenario where an Amazon has actually done this. It's a scenario where I have direct access to your device and I can pull whatever commands I need. Whether that's, you know, wherever your device is, it's sort of like an always on telemetry back to me, where I can just fetch whatever I need to. I say Amazon has done this because, I mean, they run AWS. You got an issue with AWS, they have access to all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. It's their stuff, mm-hmm. right? If you open up a case with Cisco, it's our stuff, but I can't SSH into your box, right? And I'll say this just as a free plug for Cisco. Some of our products do this. If you run UCS servers, UCS manager, any of those UCS domains, we have a product called Intersight, which does precisely this. It can hook into all of it'll help you manage your UCS stuff as well. And it can hook back into Cisco's network so that we can dynamically pull show techs and stuff from any of your UCS domains without you. And actually, it's done automatically whenever you open up a case. If your serial number matches the a product in the UCS domain that is being managed by Intersight and so on and so forth.
Very cool.
So the future is now.
You said a few minutes ago that you want to know how the device is feeling. I love that we're personifying the Nexus now. That's excellent.
Oh, I do that all the time. Yes. Yes. I give my devices pronouns.
So we are kind of getting close to the end here. Are there any funny stories or any anecdotes that you want to share from TAC?
I have so many stories. Some I can share.
Are
some
you allowed to tell?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's it. There's one towards, like, I want to say the last 6 months or so of my career, there was one case that really, like, it really got me, and I can't tell you all the solution, but I can describe something that we were considering when troubleshooting. So remember earlier I said we're not actually TAC engineers, we're lawyers, right? Given a problem, we have to look at a bunch of different evidence and rule out what could be related and what could not be related. There was this one customer who was having seemingly random links on their Nexus, on a bunch of random Nexus switches, which span multiple different, like, factory batches and stuff, both the Nexus switches themselves and the transceivers. Cables were, like, all different, just seemed like totally random. Every once in a while, links would bounce. And sometimes they would bounce a couple of times within a week. Sometimes we, you know, replace those cables and they would be 3, 4, 5, 6 months before they bounce again. So from a customer's perspective, this was very unusual because they'd open up a case. It seemed like just the link was unstable. We'd do some troubleshooting. Problem would go away. Just as a goodwill, we'd replace some transceivers. Okay, cool. 3 months later, same issue happens again, but somewhere else. Some other set of links, some other different set of switches, same thing. And because that issue was so intermittent, it was really, really difficult to track down what was related, what was not, so on and so forth. It got to the point where we had geographically identified, we had asked the customer basically where these data centers were, where these locations were, and they were not data centers, but offices actually spread out within a certain city. And we were wondering, maybe the switches are like being exposed to some environmental factor, right? Maybe the temperature is too hot or too cold, or maybe it's just right, you know, like the three bears that causes these transceivers to flap. And we're like, we tried to look at temperature data. Nothing was really matching up. And we're like, okay, well, that doesn't seem it because there's no data to support that. Well, what other environmental factors could there be? Well, what about vibration? And we were like, well, there's no earthquakes recorded near that area. It's not like a proper data center. So I wouldn't expect them to have like, you know, all the tolerances that a data center would have to that sort of thing. They were in the Midwest. So it's like, you know, earthquakes, maybe, maybe not. But either way, there's no recorded activity. But what else could cause, like, you know, switches to vibrate? Are there any trains nearby? Oh. We're like, are we really entertaining this? And we go and look on Google Maps, and within a mile of one of the offices, there's a set of train tracks. And we're like, no way. And then we go and look at the second site, because they were having this issue at two sites only. And it was in their backyard, basically, was a highway. And at this point, we're like, no way. And so we were talking with their account team, and we're like, this is a theory that we kind of have to entertain. We want to run it by you first before we ask the customer. But I think we did have to ask the customer, any known, like, is a truck going by or is a train going by whenever these links happen to flap? It got to the point where we were trying to track down the train schedules. We were trying to look historically to be like, what if during this time? We were trying to, yep. Luckily, that wasn't the case. It wasn't that. I can't tell you the solution, but it was not that. But we have historical precedents for this sort of thing happening. There's a good story one of our BU escalation engineers likes to tell where he had gotten the customer switch was having a similar kind of weird issue where, you know, links were flapping. And they had gotten the customer switch in the lab, the same switch that had the issue. They put it in the lab. They were trying to reproduce it with like similar set of transceivers and cables, and they weren't able to. And then the engineer, he had put a cell phone on top of the switch. And while he was like on the CLI or whatever, his wife called him and the vibration caused the link to flap. And we were like,
wow.
Yes.
That's so wild.
In that scenario, what happened was, I think it was the transceivers were manufactured. And this was a specific, like one specific transceiver or set of transceivers. They were manufactured to the minimum specification and the slots in the switch were manufactured to the maximum specification. And this was all within like tolerances from the factory. I'm pretty sure Cisco does the whole Six Sigma thing. So it was within tolerances, acceptable tolerances. But because they were at the very edges of both, whenever there was vibration, just the slightest vibration, the transceiver would disconnect a little bit it would jostle inside of the slot and disconnect it momentarily.
That's nuts.
That's
so
wild.
We knew that that had happened in the past. And so when we were talking about vibration, we're like, we have to entertain this like as a possibility.
Yeah.
The damn choo-choos.
So we had to ask the customer, like, hey, any trains go by recently? Yeah.
Wow. It's how did you even prove that out? Like just look at the train schedule and it didn't line up? Like
they had told us like no, because sometimes they go by like during, you know, like 3 a.m. or something like that, and something I don't remember how, but they had basically proved out, like, yeah, no, there's no, that can't be it. We were like, well, that's disappointing.
Yeah.
Because it'd be really cool for me to say root cause analysis. Yeah. The train went by, right? But
well, Lexi, don't we have to chalk that up to solar flares? I thought it was solar flares. Usually solar flares, right?
Before. Yeah. Okay. Back in a previous job, we are, I heard of the solar flare, like, root cause as like a joke. Everyone would joke about it. Like, oh, what caused that? Ha ha, solar flares, right? But then I start working at a rocket company and they're like, oh yeah, that happens.
That happens all the time.
Absolutely happens.
Wild.
Uncorrectable parity errors are the absolute worst. I've had a major escalation on that I can't talk about, but uncorrectable parity errors are absolutely terrible. They're a thing.
These cases sound so interesting and you can't tell us about
them. So, Christopher, to kind of round this out, you obviously recently made a career change from tech into your new role. What was it? Was it just time to leave tech for you? Did this role come up and it just felt like the right fit? What was the scenario?
A bit of both. Within tech, we always like to joke that like tech engineers have a shelf life. And there's some exceptions to the rule, but usually it's like around the 2 to 4 year mark or so. So it was about that time this opportunity came up. Something that I had, in my last year in tech was a little bit weird. I deviated away from taking cases every day to more of like a kind of sort of helping out with escalations, kind of sort of helping out with like systemic product quality issues and just generally like improving stuff and some automation initiatives internal to the company and that sort of thing. So I had already kind of been a little bit stepped away from the support case role, or just, you know, taking cases day in, day out. And then this opportunity came up. I had really wanted to get into hardcore network automation, which this role allows for. A lot of our testing and such is fully automated. And so part of my role is building that automation to automate that testing from end to end. And I wanted to expand my skill set a little bit more. So I know quite a bit of routing and switching. I'm not afraid of any router, any switch anywhere. I can usually hop on them and do the best I can. But in the data center space, there's a limited set of technologies, and eventually you get, you get to know them, right? This role lets me expand into other technologies like SD-WAN. I can have the opportunity to learn like ACI. What's another one? Right now I'm working on a project with NSO, which I've talked to a few people in the community about, and Cisco Crosswork. Just a lot of different stuff that I'll be able to dip my toes in and get a little bit more familiar. Granted, not at the level that a tech engineer would be able to, but at some point, like you can't, it's actually not a good idea to heavily specialize in a specific product for a very long period of time, because you can't do anything with that skill set. Most customers don't want to hire somebody who knows how to troubleshoot ASICs. They want a network engineer, right? And there's a very different skill set between those two. So sure, I can tell you exactly, you know, what the forwarding pipeline looks like for a specific product line, but that's not useful information to a customer. They're like, dude, I just asked you to set up SMB, right? So yeah, this role helps me expand the networking skill set to include some more stuff. And that way I'll be able to give better advice and so on and so forth on how to design things, how to implement solutions, that sort of thing.
That sounds really exciting.
Yeah, I'm
congratulations.
Thrilled.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Thank you.
So is there any last minute things that you want to say, anything we should have asked you that we didn't?
Plug yourself, your website, any projects you're working
on? Yeah, I mean, advice-wise, I would say, I mean, I kind of said it before, ownership is just so important. So something I've noticed is that a lot of people tend to, I don't want to say like not do their job, but they'll only take their job so far, or they'll say, you know, oh, that's outside of my skill set or outside of my responsibility or something along those lines. Own what you do and just focus on becoming excellent at that. And then, you know, go from there. I've always prided myself when I was in tech and even now on the level of ownership that I would have, where it's like I said before, if you come to me as a customer with a problem, that your problem is now my problem. It's not just my problem until I can prove it's not Cisco's problem. It's let's get this fixed within a reasonable level. Of course, I'm not going to troubleshoot some weird bug on an Arista switch or something along those lines. Ownership is if you demonstrate an extreme sense of ownership, I like to think that people will recognize that and you'll move forward in your career pretty rapidly.
That's excellent.
Great advice.
Yeah. Great advice. Yeah. Where can people find you on the socials, on the internet, blog, anything like that?
Oh yeah. Yeah, so I'm most active on Twitter. You can find me at underscore Chris J. Hart. LinkedIn, you can try to connect with me. I'm on, I think it's Christopher J. Hart 95. And if those don't do it for you, chrisjhart.com has my links to everything. That's my blog that all my stuff gets posted on.
Excellent.
Well, thanks. It's been great having you.
Yeah, thank you.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me. It's been awesome.
Yay.
Well, that
love hearing about tax stuff. Yeah, crazy stories.
This is really cool, and I really love to get into that mindset, because it's tech engineers are people that we all in IT interface with somewhat often, mm-hmm. and I always kind of high levelly try to think about what's a day to day for somebody like that, because it's just got to be nuts some days, if not all days. So really appreciate the perspective. This was great.
Also, absolutely, Christopher, yeah. I just want to say thank you for everything you do for the community. You are a very helpful presence.
I try.
I have definitely asked you several questions before, or like a million. You've helped me find some interesting, at least dig deep into some interesting problems. So I really appreciate that. It's been fun. Yeah, and I know you do that for others as well. So. You're a great force.
My philosophy is I got where I am in my career thus far because other people decided to publish stuff, content, whether it's for blog posts or answering questions on Stack Overflow and that kind of thing. So I figure, well, I can do that too. Anybody can do it. And hopefully I do it well.
You do. You're very much appreciated. We love you.
Well, Christopher Hart, thank you very much for joining us. Lexi, great show tonight. Thank you very much. And to all the A1 fans and Patreons, thank you for joining us as always. You can always check out our Patreon program at patreon.com/artofneteng. We will see you all soon. Take care.
Hey, y'all. This is Lexi. If you vibe with what you heard us talking about today, we'd love for you to subscribe to our podcast in your favorite podcatcher. Also, go ahead and hit that bell icon to make sure you're notified of all our future episodes right when they come out. If you want to hear what we're talking about when we're not on the podcast, you can totally follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Art of NetEng. That's Art of NETENG. You can also find a bunch more info about us and the podcast at artofnetworkengineering.com. Thanks for listening.